So I'd like to welcome everyone here this afternoon. Most of you travelled from Bangkok, quite a long way. What I plan to do is to give a general introductory talk for maybe 40-45 minutes, after which there'll be a short break just to stretch your legs, and then we'll have a meditation session for about half an hour, and after that we'll have a questions and answers session. I think many of you are very new or quite new to Buddhism, and some of you already have a fair amount of experience, then I'm sure the questions will be, interests will be quite varied. So to try to cover everything as well as I can in the short time we have, I think the questions and answer session is probably the best way to do that. And planning to finish at 3:30, but I'm still available after that if anybody wants to stay on and chat more informally. The reason for ending at 3:30 is really I'm just worried you're going to get stuck in traffic jams on the way to back to Bangkok. But if anybody does want to stay on after that and chat, they're very welcome to do so. Okay, I'd like to begin with a few of general remarks about Buddhism, or Theravada Buddhism, this particular school of Buddhism, the one in which I've trained and which I've studied to some extent. I'd like to start off with a general classification of religions, that it seems to me we can distinguish between the religions that originated in the Middle East and those that originated in India. And the religions that originated in the Middle East, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, monotheistic religions can be classified as belief systems. They are religions in which faith plays the predominant role. And that being the case, in the West, we've tended to understand religion as to be primarily a matter of faith. And indeed, these religions are often referred to as the great faiths. And that being so, there's often the tendency to apply that same standard to the religions that grew up in India. I think it's that misapplication which leads to a lot of confusion or misunderstanding about the nature of Buddhism. The religions that grew up in India, speaking most particularly here about Buddhism, are not belief systems. I would characterize them as, or I would characterize Buddhism as, an education system. So this is the first distinction I'd like to make here between religion as belief system and religion as education system. If we try to look at Buddhism as a belief system and say, what do Buddhists believe in, or Buddhists believe in reincarnation, and Buddhists believe that the world is suffering and all these kind of things, then we're already well on the way to a complete misunderstanding of what Buddhism is all about. So the first step to understanding this is to consider it's a different kind of religion. It's a different sort of religion, an education system. Now, what do I mean by an education system? And is there a role for faith in an education system? Any endeavor in life, whether it's considered a secular or a religious endeavor, is dependent on taking on certain beliefs. Even scientific research is based on certain beliefs about our ability to understand the world through the means of the senses, and certain implicit beliefs about the nature of reality. So it's a matter of making those beliefs conscious and understanding what belief is. So in Buddhism, we say it's an education system which incorporates faith or a certain kind of faith, but it's one that also insists on including the nature of faith within the range of those things to be studied. The word for faith used in the ancient Buddhist scriptures is satta, and you'll find if you look in the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, that wherever this word occurs, it's always accompanied by the word banya, or faith, or wisdom, as it's usually translated, or discernment. As I say, it's considered that any kind of belief which lacks that willingness to apply one's critical intelligence to is not Buddhist faith. And in Buddhism, we make a clear distinction between faith and knowledge. To say faith applies when you haven't experienced something for yourself, and you can choose to believe that it's true or not. But however strongly you believe in something, that belief is not knowledge, at least as Buddhism understands the word knowledge. Now often, if somebody believes in something very strongly, believes in it so strongly that they have no doubts at all, they tend to confuse that strong faith with knowledge. They say, I know. And you say, what do you mean when you say, I know? You say, I believe. And so we get this kind of circular reasoning that I believe because it's true, and it's true because I believe it. And this is one of the basic foundations for a great deal of strife and conflict in the world, because if you think that something is true because you have no doubts in it and you feel in your heart that it must be true, then you're inevitably going to have problems when you meet other people or other groups who have exactly the same intuitive certainty about something which you have dismissed as false. And a great deal of difficulty is how you relate to somebody who is equally sure that they're right about something that you're sure is wrong. Classic responses to this dilemma are try to have nothing to do with those people and just mix with the people who have the same belief as you do, and you can constantly reinforce your faith. Or you can try and perhaps force people who have a different belief to you to change their beliefs and adopt yours. Or perhaps you can try methods of persuasion of one kind and another. But whatever method you choose, When you confuse faith with knowledge, you're always going to have a problem with us and them. And it's very difficult to transcend that, unless perhaps you answer it by saying, well, we both believe in the same things, we're just using different language, which is kind of the secular humanist way of dealing with this kind of problem. And Buddhism, anyway, says that believe whatever you want to believe, but don't believe your belief to be knowledge. Be humble and realize that whatever you believe, it's not necessarily so. And if all the members of all the different religions in the world had that kind of humility, probably the world would be a lot better place to live in than it is right now. But Buddhism says faith is important because it clarifies the mind. It enables you to make choices, a clear choice, and to follow a path clearly. And it gives you energy and effort. If you look at faith as a means of believing that something has value, then whatever you believe has value or gives meaning to your life, then you're going to commit yourself to that actually quite strongly. So the Buddha, the word Buddha is a title, and it's a title given to a human being who realizes the supreme, the highest thing that a human being can realize, and he does so without a teacher. And the Buddha of our era was born 2,500 years ago in India, born into a princely family, and after 6 or 7 years of struggle and experimentation, he realized we call Nibbana or enlightenment, whatever you want to call that. Now the essence of that experience of enlightenment was that every kind of greed, every trace of anger, hatred, aversion, every delusion was completely dispelled, was completely ended. And in its place, his mind became filled with wisdom and compassion. Now, so the Buddhist faith that steps you off on this education process is there is such a thing as enlightenment. It's the highest thing that a human being can realize. The Buddha realized it, and the teachings that he gave regarding the nature of the world, the mind, and the method by which other human beings can realize what he realized is valid, it's authentic, it works. This is the kind of basic faith that a Buddhist needs. So there's no way that we can prove what happened 2,500 years ago in India. But there is an application to our lives in that the Buddha made it very clear that he started off, he practiced, he realized as a human being and as a, we can say, as a representative of the human race, and his enlightenment proved the capacity of human beings for enlightenment and thereby the capacity of all of us for enlightenment. So if you read in the book that it says a Buddhist has faith in the Buddha's enlightenment, how that applies here and now is that it implies within it a belief in our own capacity for enlightenment. And the Buddha made very clear that that capacity for enlightenment is present both within men and women, and people of all races and backgrounds. So this is the faith that leads on to this educational process. Now, the education I'm talking about here means a training, a development, a cultivation of all aspects of our life, our, the way we behave, the way we relate to the world we live in, the people around us. It refers to a training of emotion and a training of our wisdom faculty and intelligence. So this all-round training, education, cultivation is referred to in a Pali word, bhavana, which is usually translated into English as meditation. And it's somewhat unfortunate that that translation has led to a very reductionist or narrow understanding of what the Buddhist education process is. And this is meditation is a matter of sitting in a certain way with your eyes closed and concentrating on an object or doing various insight techniques or walking up and down and doing the same kind of thing. Certainly these are integral parts of Buddhist education, but they are not all of it by any means. And the Buddha is stressed that this education cannot be carried on in one particular area of our lives while neglecting the other areas. The Buddhist teachings have to be applied in every part of our lives. So if we don't give a lot of thought to how we relate to our family members, the people at work, people around us, the society in which we live in, then in our daily life we'll be fostering the very qualities that in formal meditation practice, the sitting and the walking, we're trying to eradicate. So it's like walking one step forward and two steps backwards. So there's to be a harmony and an application to all parts of our daily life. Making my distinction at the beginning of the talk between religion as belief system and education system, I think this can be seen quite clearly with relation to morality. Now, in the theistic systems, morality is considered to be laid down by the deity, the supreme deity or God, for human beings to follow and to obey, and there is reward and punishment involved. And because the morality is derived from God, then there is a question of intercession, there's a question of prayer and asking to be forgiven, and so on and so forth. In Buddhism, there is no conception that the Buddha laid down, you know, what's right and what's wrong, and rewards or punishes people. The idea is that the Buddha is someone who understood the nature, human nature, the way things are, the way the world is, and taught the most skillful and intelligent way to live in the world in order to harmonize with those laws. And That being so, the moral code is one which is based on human psychology, and most particularly volition or intention. So the training in morality is a training of volition. Now, generally speaking, we're not very skilled in separating volition from action, especially under pressure, when we don't really have time to think about things. We find we've already acted and already spoken by the time we realize that that wasn't such a wise thing to do or wasn't in line with our principles or our ideals. And the Buddha's teaching of mindfulness and being awake and present to our actions seems reasonable, but it's extremely difficult to do. But one of the points about mindfulness is that you have to be mindful of something. Mindfulness needs a peg or pegs. And that's why mindfulness is closely akin to memory. It's a certain kind of memory. Now, as far as morality is considered, the moral training, the training of conduct, of body and speech, the skillful means the Buddha gave us is to voluntarily adopt certain standards of conduct and speech, and to reflect on those often, so that they become almost second nature to us. So that in the case that we might be tempted to hurt somebody, or to speak harshly, or to do something dishonest, then as we consider that action, or as we're about to perform that action, then if we've really given ourselves to this study and training, the memory, the mindfulness of a precept, of a standard, a training standard, pops up into our mind that no, this is against the precept. So it's not that that there's someone going to punish us, we do, but there's this awareness, we become awake in that moment, that what we're planning to do conflicts with the standard that we have adopted. And if you have a ability to be patient and just to bear with that impulse to act, then that impulse to act passes away. And it's at that moment that you have a moment of insight, and you see that that impulse is not who you really are. It's a passing impulse, which is the product of certain causes and conditions, and that you don't have to act upon it. And it's here where you drive a wedge in between volition and action, that you first experience a sense of freedom and the ability to choose wisely. But as long as you lack that kind of mindfulness and clear standards to be mindful of, then we're usually wise after the event. So mindfulness means the ability to apply your intelligence and wisdom at the moment when it's most needed, and the moment when there's some conflict and some pressure upon you to act in an unskillful way. So the determining factor is volition. Now, certain acts may seem to be reasonable or to be permitted under certain circumstances, but if one still has the volition to act, then the karma has been created. So let's say, a case of killing another human being, the worst kind of kamma would be in the case of someone who plans a murder long in advance and determines to do it in the cruelest, most awful way. Whereas a much weaker case might be mercy killing, euthanasia, or a soldier who's been drafted into the army against his will and forced onto the battlefield and kills somebody else to save their own life. But whatever the reasons might be, and however sympathetic one might be to them, the determining factor of whether kamma has been created or not is whether there has been the intention to kill, and whether that intention has been acted upon and is successful. So the intensity of the kamma is affected by the reasons, but not the production of kamma itself. So on the question of kamma, again, this is not something which is always so clear-cut. Not so easily seen. Again, there is a certain necessity for faith or trust. Often you hear people who die a horrible death or have some bad experience, and they say, "Oh, it's because I did this when I was a child," or obviously that's just the result of that. But kamma is far more complex than that, and is very rarely so clearly seen as you steal something from them and then a few days later or a few years later someone steals something from you. It's far more complex than that, and certain aspects of the law of kamma have to be taken on trust. But they can also be verified in certain areas. That's particularly the area in which you can verify kamma, is that every time you act upon a particular impulse, then that action becomes more likely in the future. You create habits. If you've never done, let's say, a particular unwholesome, unkind act, if you've never done it before, and you feel that it's wrong, shouldn't be done, then there is a certain taboo and a real resistance to performing that action. But let's say that you lose your mindfulness, or you're provoked, and then you do perform that act, then you'll notice that to perform that act a second time is much less difficult than the first time. And if you do it more than two or three times, it can become quite easy and could even become an habitual action. And this is a very good example of law of kamma, where we create grooves in the mind, in particular ways of action. Because there is so much going on in our life, a lot of times we're acting on automatic pilot. And people often say, "I didn't really mean to do that. I'm sorry. I was tense, or I was rushed." But the reason why that should be the automatic response in that particular situation for you is because of your actions and speech in the past, which have created that kind of furrow, or that created that kind of rut in which your mind falls most easily. So the Buddha then stressed that kamma is created by volition, and that morality, to be strong and a part of this Buddhist education, is one which we need to be mindful of volition, and we're mindful of volition by having precepts to be mindful of, which illuminate volition, as a impermanent mental phenomena arising according to causes and conditions. And it's not a philosophical concept, this is something that you can see quite clearly for yourself. But what is particular about Buddhist morality is that it's considered to be part of a training and that it is intimately connected with the other parts of the training. Now, if you act in unskillful ways and speak in unskillful ways, then almost inevitably you're going to feel guilty about it afterwards. If you don't feel guilty, or you don't want to feel guilty, maybe you may justify it to yourself, or you may kind of repress what you've done or make excuses for yourself, but there are traces left there. Now, if you live a very busy, superficial kind of life, a lot of distractions, a lot of things going on, where you don't ever have to be with yourself very much, then you may not notice this so clearly. Whenever you feel uncomfortable with yourself, then go and have something to eat, go and watch a movie, chat with someone on the telephone, do something. But if you start to apply yourself to an inner cultivation, practice of meditation, where you're willing to abandon distractions and to be completely present with yourself, with your own mind and body, then all the things that you can keep under the surface in your daily life become very apparent to you. And often it can feel like you're actually going backwards when you start meditating, and you see a lot of anger and irritation and kinds of things can pop up into your mind, and you think, before I meditated, I wasn't like this. I was a really nice person. I didn't get angry with people. But a lot of things that you've been holding down will just kind of bubble up to the surface. But what you'll see particularly is that you don't get away with anything. There's nothing free, and that if you you can be sitting and meditating and everything's going quite well and you're quite mindful, and suddenly up into your mind pops memory of something mean you did yesterday, or something unkind you said to somebody, and it cannot just be yesterday, it can be a week ago, a month ago, years ago. And it's as if we have a kind of a tape recorder or a some kind of a device within our mind that, as we become more clear and more relaxed, then the memory of these things comes up in our mind. And it's here that we'll see just how important it is to be scrupulous, careful with regards to how we act and how we speak. It becomes very clear in meditation that no great inner peace can be realized unless one sorts out the quality of one's actions and speech in daily life. Now, the practice of meditation is one which includes, I'm talking about cultivation of the mind here, is one which includes various kinds of techniques. But particularly, I think, in the West, where it's information-oriented, and we think that problems can be addressed, can be dealt with through more information, that when we start to meditate, we think if we get all the information, get all the tricks and the techniques and everything just down, then we'll be successful. And this is why meditation, I'm using this in a more kind of loose way here, is a very humbling activity, because it's not one that you can use willpower in the same way. Willpower is something which is of use for the practice or the training of body and speech, being self-disciplined, being able to refrain from things that you like, to defer gratification in certain cases. But on the level of the mind, making a firm determination and gritting your teeth and getting down to it, and it's not always that successful, because the mind has to be in a very relaxed, pliable kind of state, And it's a skill and an art to train the mind. Now, if you read books about Buddhist meditation, often the wisdom side is emphasized. The vipassana side is emphasized. And indeed, in the States, a number of places in the West, people prefer to refer themselves as vipassana practitioners rather than Buddhists. And as identification with vipassana as kind of the heart of Buddhism, that which makes Buddhism unique, and so on. And this idea that vipassana is something separate from and higher than techniques to concentrate the mind. But an analogy here might be with worldly kind of education and the distinction between IQ and EQ. It's considered that for success in education, generally IQ accounts for about 20% and EQ 80%. And if you, perhaps we may consider it, let me compare it to bullets, let's say in a case where you're using a gun in a legitimate way, not to kill anybody. And wisdom, intelligence is like bullets, but EQ is like the gun. You can have lots of bullets and they can be very effective, but if you don't have a gun or your gun doesn't work, it's not gonna shoot anything. And if you have knowledge and understanding of anything, but you lack the emotional maturity to make use of it, then may well not be effective at all. And so in meditation, there are two aspects. There's the aspect which deals with the emotional level, and there's the aspect which deals with the intellectual or cognitive level. So certain meditation techniques emphasize that which is seeking the emotional benefits and emotional maturity, whereas the so-called vipassana techniques are emphasizing the cognitive aspects. But these two are in reality inseparable. Now, one of the values of concentrating the mind or being able to maintain awareness in the present moment is that one, that you develop an ability to dwell in the present moment without either falling into drowsiness or without being carried away with thoughts and fantasies and imagination. So an ability to dwell awake, aware, but without mental gossip proliferation. It means being able to dwell still amongst things which are encouraging you to either like or dislike, and to attach to or to reject. And for the wisdom faculty to really achieve its aims of seeing the nature of reality as a direct experience, this is a most important precondition, that the mind is still and clear without moving towards the pleasant and moving away from the unpleasant. And this is one of the abilities which is conferred by steady mindfulness over a period of time, which results in a stillness which we call samadhi. Now, another aspect of this is that when the mind becomes still and calms down, it gives rise naturally to a sense of bliss and a very deep, profound kind of happiness. And this is a wonderful discovery, because we've all of us heard, I'm sure, since we were kids, that true happiness lies within, and money doesn't solve all your problems and doesn't make you really happy, and all those kinds of sayings, and we pay lip service to them perhaps, but we don't really believe it, because we've never experienced this inner bliss ourselves, and we're of course wary of throwing away what happiness we do have, apparently, for something which we may never realize. Now, the ability to access this inner peace, inner bliss, you can call that a samatha, or an accomplishment of concentration, but it has great implications for the whole way we understand ourselves, we understand life, the way that we conduct ourselves. For one thing, it gives us for the first time a perspective on the usual kinds of sources of pleasure that we have in our lives, and gives us more willingness to weigh up the pros and cons, and to see whether all of the kinds of pleasure that we experience in our life are really worth it. But even if we weigh them up and we consider that they are worth it, then we will at least not be drawn into acting in immoral or harmful ways through a desire for that happiness. It's like if you've got a huge amount of money in the bank, even though you may still say, let's say you win the lottery and you have a huge amount of money, you may well still decide that you still want to carry on working because you enjoy working, even though you don't need the money anymore. So even though you decide to carry on working and receiving a wage, even though you might not strictly need it, it's highly unlikely that you would be dishonest or try to cheat other people, because there's no need. And similarly, when you have this kind of inner peace, then inner happiness, then there's no need to be acting in unskillful, harmful ways out of this sense of inner lack and neediness. So that access to inner peace, inner happiness, gives us this contentment and gives us the ability to and the courage to look at our minds more and more clearly. Now, one of the teachings for which Buddhism is very well known is that Buddhism teaches that life is suffering. Again, this is a rather inaccurate translation and understanding. Let's say, first of all, that the word dukkha covers a very wide, huge variety of experiences. It's translated as unsatisfactoriness. Can also be translated as lack, the sense that we lack something. No matter how pleasurable we find things and however well life is going, there's always a sense that there's just something, we don't quite know what, missing. It's not quite right. It's not it yet. And so the Buddha says that everything except for Nibbana is fundamentally insecure and fundamentally, or in the last resort, unsatisfactory. That there is a deep yearning in the mind for enlightenment, and that as long as the mind is unenlightened, then it will never be totally free of that sense of lack. Now, that sense of lack can vary from very subtle perception to very coarse kinds of physical and mental suffering. But that whole spectrum of experience, all non-enlightened experience, is summed up under this one word of of dukkha. And it's for the comprehension and for the understanding of what dukkha means that this education is undertaken, because it's through understanding dukkha that one is free from it. And this is a very basic principle of Buddha's teaching, is that we only ever transcend something, we're only ever really free from something through thoroughly comprehending it, both intellectually, emotionally, and understanding it as a direct experience. Now, the first noble truth of dukkha, now this dukkha has a cause of ignorance and craving, and it has an end. It doesn't have to be like this, and there is a path towards its end, this path of training of body, speech and mind. Now, given that the most important concept or word there is dukkha, it has led to this understanding or perception of Buddhism looks on the world as suffering and is kind of pessimistic, without taking into account, of course, Buddhism says, well, the whole point of religious life is to go beyond that, and it is possible, which is a much more optimistic view than is generally credited. But also, the Buddha taught very clearly that the only way that you can understand suffering and the only way that you can transcend suffering is when your mind is happy. So this is the path is a path of increasing happiness, and the culmination of this path of happiness is the complete penetration of the nature of suffering. Meditation is a path of happiness. It's teaching you more intelligent, more sustainable ways of experiencing happiness. Everybody wants to be happy, but very few people are very systematic and intelligent about the way they look for happiness. But the Buddha says that any kind of goodness, intelligent action will lead to a sense of inner buoyancy and inner well-being. And if that inner well-being is cultivated further, it gives rise to bliss and happiness, and the happy mind becomes concentrated, and the concentrated mind sees things as they truly are. So the Buddha made very clear that happiness and pleasure, when it's coming from blameless sources, is not only to not to be avoided, but it's something definitely to be cultivated. So the happy mind is a strong mind. If you can see this just generally, if you're in a happy frame of mind and somebody comes to you with their problems, then you're very likely to be much more likely to be patient and to be able to listen to them well and to be able to help them however you can than if yourself you're full of inner worries and doubts and anxieties, and you're so caught up in your own problems you have little time for anybody else's. And the ability to stay with something and to be able to look at it carefully and clearly means that the state of the mind and the emotional state of the mind is as important as the particular knowledge and information that you might have. So the path of meditation is one which depends on mindfulness, ability to be clear, awake, bright here in the present moment, and to by that to experience or to investigate the nature of happiness and unhappiness, and to be and to experience for yourself that the extent to which you can abandon unwholesome thoughts of greed, hatred and delusion is the extent to which you yourself experience inner peace and happiness, and also you have that kind of resource to be able to help other people. So these are a few preliminary sort of reflections and thoughts about Buddhist teaching. Given the time constraint, somewhat sketchy. But anyway, after we have our meditation session, then there will be time for anyone to ask any questions, either about what I've been talking about just now or anything else at all which you'd rather talk about. But right now I'd like to give everyone a break for 5 minutes or so if anybody wants to stretch their legs and use the bathroom, whatever, and then we'll come back in, say, at 20 past, and we'll have a meditation session.